versus the amount of feeling I get of being in a group of people who care about the same things. Normally I feel more alone, and also in the quickness that I feel open conversations and eyes like this. So I want to thank Lior and Asaf for organizing it, and maybe a good time to give them a nice big round of applause. So I'm going to talk about some scientific results. Before I do that, I want to say some framing about the scientific, about how we do science, because usually in science we learn thousands of hours of physics, chemistry, biology, but not 1 hour about how we actually get there. Okay, so this has to do with the mental schema we have when we come to do research. I'll tell you now about, it's a big secret they don't tell us in science. All right. So if you believe the way papers are written or textbooks, you're liable to, first maybe about schema. So as we heard, when I come to do something, let's say maybe touch these glasses here, not mine, my brain builds a prediction of what's going to happen. We heard about that. So first part of the movement. If my prediction gets, that's a schema. If I get blocked, I get this kind of shock. The world isn't the way it's supposed to be. And that means our schema had better be as accurate as possible, let's call it this way. So if we what's our schema when we come to do research? If we believe the way that papers are written, we're liable to have the following schema. We think like this. Say A is the question, B is the answer, research is a straight arrow. Can you see this marking here?
Yes.
You? Can you see it? No, you can't see it? So. Better? The problem with the schema is that if your experiment doesn't work or your student gets depressed, it's perceived as something fundamentally wrong with the way the world is supposed to be. Right? So I teach my students a different schema from day one. I learned this from improvisation theater, where you learn immediately that you get on stage, you get stuck, you get stuck, basically, and everybody else tries to support you and make you look good, basically. That's improvisation theater. So I teach them a different schema. I'd say A is the question, right? B is the answer. You start going, and experiments don't work. And they don't work. They don't work. They don't work. They don't work. Until you reach a place linked with negative emotion. And here's, we have a word. Words are very powerful. We call this the cloud. That's what we call it in our group, the cloud. Right here, the cloud. The cloud of research. And you can be stuck in the cloud for a distribution of times that has a long tail. It could be maybe a week, a month, a year, a PhD thesis, a whole career, you die, you're reincarnated as a scientist, you're still in the cloud, in circles of, until, I don't know how long, but if you have enough support, then sometimes in the materials at hand, you see a new answer, right? We call it C, and you decide to go for it. And then experiments don't work, but you get there, right? You get there, and then you write a paper, A, arrow, C, which is a very good way to communicate, very clear. As long as there's a culture, we don't forget the way you got from A to C, which is more like this. And this cloud is an inherent part of doing research. It stands at the boundary here between the known and the unknown. Because in order to discover something truly new, at least one of your basic assumptions has to change. Otherwise, it's not new. And that's a disorienting feeling. And therefore, in science, and also in improvisation, what we try to do every day is bring ourselves to this uncomfortable place between the known and the unknown. Now, notice I put B in the land of the known. For a scientist, it's like our proposal in our PhD, our proposal in our grant or something. It's very important to have a good B, a nice, strong frame, rich, fruitful, because otherwise we have no direction. But C is almost always more fruitful, original, shocking, unexpected, etc. That's why we go to get it, right, into the land of the unknown. Everyone in my lab knows this. So students often come to me and say, Uri, I'm in the cloud. And I say, great, you must be feeling miserable. You must be feeling frustrated. But I'm kind of happy because maybe we stand a chance to be at the boundary between the known and the unknown. In other words, finally, we're at the cloud phase, the normal cloud phase of research. And that detoxifies the feeling that I had as a student, something's wrong with me. if I'm stuck, I'm not like Einstein and Newton, that I never heard that they got stuck, right, of course. Therefore, I can't be a scientist. Therefore, I'm not worthy to step across the threshold of the university. I had that quite depressing feeling in the middle of my PhD. So I want to offer this, before I give you my A arrow B talk, okay, which is not history, it's historiography of what happened. And I'll be glad to tell you about this also if you'd like. Maybe before I say, would anybody, first of all, who recognizes the cloud in their experience? I don't know if in France it also, okay, some. And would anybody like to respond to this concept? And I'm going to wait till somebody responds before I continue. The fog, a different word. Yeah, you can have different metaphors for it. Exploration and creativity theory. How do you get out of the cloud? What works for you, artists and scientists and others, and people who aren't?
New intuition.
New intuition. How you get it?
Step away. Just come.
Step away. So one thing I want to say, in my experience, for many people, taking a well-timed vacation is part of the scientific method. Take a new vacation, you get into a new world of metaphors. Your problem is simmering in the back of your mind. You find a new metaphor, just like Archimedes saw the water rising in the bathtub and understood Archimedes' law. I can measure the weight of the crown. Yeah, how else?
Well, the cloud, it sounds like it's cloudy, but sometimes it's not cloudy. It's a place of exploration which can be very interesting.
Absolutely. This could be linked with positive emotions. Yeah. So I want to talk about how you get that curiosity. So one way is to take a vacation, step back.
Give up on order.
Order. Can you say more? Give up. What do you mean, give up on order?
Accept
it. Yeah. Yes? Yeah.
Work on a different project.
Yeah.
And portfolio.
Yeah, so this is something, again, in science we have a myth that science is done alone. So science is often done alone, but never in isolation. So you can't do science in isolation. You need to have someone to talk to. What's the properties of that someone to talk to? What kind of person do you seek?
A good listener.
Why a good listener? Because a good listener says, tell me more. You say, tell me more. Tell me more. Good listener makes you talk. You say more. Tell me more. I have nothing more to say. Tell me more. Then you discover a second voice inside you that nobody had nobody to listen to, and that carries a different point of view. A lot of times that's the way you see another point of view. Of course, experts. Okay. So let's keep that here. As I switch to a PowerPoint, which also signals the switch to the, for those of you that aren't from science, this is what, as you saw today, science looks like this, a lot of times, science meetings, sitting and looking at a shimmering screen, okay? I don't know how to make it work, actually. So let's have a look. It's a very linear kind of description, okay? So I'm saying this particularly because everything is a paradox, right? So this is what actually happened. This is the story I'm going to tell you now about. Now we're in the cloud of the screen. Yeah. Maybe we use this time to hear some more from you, the audience, about this.
Yeah. Something about taking a distance from the question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so how do you do that? How do you take a distance from the question?
To talk to the person, then you recognize some other side of yourself. This also means that you have a distance from the first point of, where you started the question.
Right.
To me, it has also a lot to do with self, because if I take a distance from myself and from me wanting to obtain a result, maybe I can broaden.
How do you take a step away from yourself?
By not being so concerned.
How? How?
By stepping back.
It's like a mental process. Oh, so
maybe
good.
Yeah. Maybe the cloud is the answer. And you see that as
So can you say more? Maybe the cloud is the answer, she says.
And
you don't see it as an answer. Maybe the cloud is the answer. You know, as a mentor, I also want to share with you, when a student says, Uri, I'm in the cloud, and I say, great, I also know what to do as a mentor. Okay, so instead of ignoring that student and looking for projects that are successful. Or calling up my biological supply company and ordering a whip in order to supply some psychological pressure, like this. I do something else, because research in psychology shows that when you're feeling fear, your mind narrows down to conservative ways of thinking, which explains a lot of politics, actually. If you want to explore creative paths, you need other emotions. It's all emotional. You need solidarity and hope, which are emotions that are foundations for this playful curiosity, somebody said. How do you get solidarity and hope is a puzzle that I love, come to love, is the most favorite part of being a scientist, because you have to figure out what it means for your relationship with that student. It's different for every person, right? Different people have different ideas what solidarity and hope, but definitely this other person to talk to on a daily basis that you respect, that's a good listener, I think is a relationship that's essential to science, and it's one of our tasks to nurture it, and if you don't have it right now, then I would open up this task in your mind to make, it's an investment in a relationship that's also essential for being a scientist, not only pleasant and pleasurable. And so solidarity and hope, yeah. All right. Asaf, are you going to? Okay. So, yeah. This gonki? This is a word we have in English, disconki. I always think it sounds a lot like French, disconki. Does that make sense for French people? Disconki? No? Does it sound French? For us, it sounds French because we don't speak French. Oh, from the south of France, yeah. Again, cross cultural, and I'm here. So, yeah. Yeah.
Regarding the power, so I feel like taking the vacation is the second part, but there's a lot of work also to prepare the recap. It's not like.
So let me see if I understand what you're saying. Saying taking the vacation is the second part, but the first part is a lot of work preparing for the
Eureka
moment.
Yeah. But that actually wandering in the cloud.
Wandering in the cloud, yeah?
Is part of.
I agree. So wandering in the cloud is so we want sometimes, because of negative emotions, to get out of it as quickly as possible, right?
Yeah.
Want to, but we have to admit it. But for what I find is just having a word for it makes you conscious of it, and that gives you suddenly freedom. Why does it give you freedom? Because instead of doing your normal pattern, you have another option, maybe to do something different. And the more you have that other option, the more freedom you have. And that also is an advisor. Okay, so maybe I should say that if you want to share this with your friends, I did a talk on TED that has this concept. And I get a lot of interesting emails thanks to this TED from different fields. The mirror game. 2015? Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that's great. I'm just checking.
Yeah. Well, maybe as this screen is coming up, what something else I'd like to learn from you or hear from you? Yeah? Actually, get data. And I'm guessing what you're saying, when you say someone, go do something, you observe a person who's paralyzed. So for some personality types, by the way, I observe several phenotypes of scientists. And one phenotype is being paralyzed in situations we deeply care about. Others, and then you say for that person, the action is the liberating step, right? Because it's a vicious cycle. So, by the way, there's others. There's people who are in the cloud. What they do is they start up new interesting projects. These people have 17 open projects at a time. And so that's another phenotype. So I think doing a PhD in science is training in coping with your personality in the unknown. That's what you get from a PhD. It's a huge transferable skills because all the A-B jobs in the world have been programmed. These are the interesting jobs in the world, not only in science. And what you learn in a PhD, in my opinion, is the ability to cope with your personality in this space, not only the other virtues of science, like truth-telling, we don't discover the truth, but we tell the truth. We try to tell the truth so other people can repeat our experience. Truth-telling, quantitation, organized skepticism, and all the other virtues of science. But being together in the unknown, that's it's like if you want to have someone who does these 21st century problems, get a scientist who's a PhD student. And okay, now I'm going to talk about studying joint creativity and in creativity and joint improvisation. Okay, this person, Leon Noy, is not only the organizer, he's also the person who originated these two paradigms. It started from both of us being in, I'm a physicist who works in molecular biology. My world is refrigerators, centrifuges, whips, people stuck in the clouds. Okay. But on the side, I also, and also Leo, do this improvisation theater where we ask someone from the audience to tell a story on stage. We listen to it, and we improvise a scene on the spot with empathy, the idea being to connect people in the audience through stories. We do this with different audiences all across Israel, and it's very satisfying. Sometimes we sense in this performance moments where the actors and the audience together, we think, feel a high moment of high quality. It's very brief, but there's like these moments where it's everybody's like this. And we're wondering how to study these moments, what's going on there. We're thinking about this for several years. And we can call them togetherness for the purpose of this talk. And it's related to concepts like group flow, group creativity, comunitas in anthropology, being in the zone in sports, etc. It's an opening to which everyone present contributes, etc. Okay. We were thinking how to do this, to study it. It's so rare in life, maybe also engaging conversations, scientific conversations that open things. It's so rare in life, how can we bring it into the lab? Talking. We realized that in theater, right under our nose, there's a simple exercise every theater person and dance person knows, which aim to bring people into the state of togetherness. And we thought this could be like the hydrogen atom of this process, something we can actually study. It's called the mirror game, and we talked about it. We heard a talk about the 3D mirror game today in the short talks. Tommy Himberg and Rita Hari studied the 3D mirror game. So this is like the future. This is 7 years before Tommy's work. So we were thinking, I just want to try it with you guys. Okay, I'm going to do the mirror game with you next to each other. But I want to say, not everyone. I want at least one-third people to be observers, okay, of this process. And the rest of you to try the mirror game. And what is it? So you'll sit and face your partner. It's like one person will move their hand, and the other person will be their mirror. Okay? And you do that for a while. And then I'm going to say, now switch leaders. So the person who was following will now be the leader. Okay, and you just make interesting motion together. Okay. Not just interesting motion. And then I'm going to say, now there's no leader and no follower. And follow the follower. Both of you continue, but now there's no designated leader. And we'll do that for a while. All right? So I'd like to ask if you want to turn to someone sitting next to you. If you want to play the mirror game, it'll be enjoyable. And the other people can be observers. You also have a role. Observers, your role is to observe. Okay. Okay. And now choose someone to be the leader to start with, and that leader would lead, and the other one be their mirror, please. And of course, it's not a competition, it's a cooperative game. So help the other person follow you. Okay. Now in 3 seconds, I'm going to ask you to change. Now the follower becomes the leader. Please change. Very good. And in 3 seconds, I'm going to ask you now to continue with no leader and no follower. Please continue. Okay, now we'll do another 30 seconds, and please bring it to an elegant and graceful closing. All good things must come to an end. And thank your partner. Can you finish? Okay. And I'd like now to ask you to turn back this way to me. And first of all, I want to ask those people who participated in the mirror game, I'm going to ask the observers soon too, to say something about this experience. What was it like to be a leader? What was it like to be a follower? What was it like to be in a situation with no leader and no follower? What did you observe? Yeah. Easy to be the leader, okay. Let's continue, yeah. Easy to be the follower, okay. Let's shower me with experiences, please. Yeah. It, that togetherness was hard. Making it simple helps it to be more together, yeah. In the joint condition, we were switching leadership. What more? When she was leading, I was more comfortable looking at her eyes than her hand sometimes.
I just felt like something like when we're doing both the same movement, that we're moving like from something organized to something more chaotic, like when we're doing something different, but to come back to order. Like, so basically it was tempting to come back to follow.
It was tempting to come back to order, organized motion. As a leader, there was a second consciousness aware of how easy am I to follow.
Yeah.
I'm repeating, of course, because it's not always easy to hear in this situation. That's why I'm repeating. I want to just
make it. Double consciousness.
It's a double con. You were conscious of your double consciousness. Yes. Yeah. Triple consciousness. And making it interesting enough. Okay. Good. That's cool. Okay, now I want to hear from the observers. Please tell us what you saw. Asti.
Yeah, I'll take a cue from Ella.
Yeah.
Eye contact is the key to it all. So if it arouses people's appetite, I recommend to do the game and never look at the hands that move, just look at your partner's eyes. And find the distance where you can see, which is about 1 meter, where you can see peripherally the body of your partner, but you never are allowed. It's a rule. To look at the body only in the eyes, and then you'll be flying.
So Ati says, look at the eyes, not the body. It's a route to enlightenment. Yeah.
We can usually say who is leading because of the slight delay between the movements.
As an observer, you could see who is leading because of the delay. Yeah. Even when it's not the person who's designated as a leader. Yeah. All right. So you can even say, a skeptic would say, there's no such thing as joint improvisation with a leader and follower. It's difficult to be able to actually have a state where there is no leader and follower changing every second. Like, the skeptic could say that, right? So that's the kind of question we want to ask in the lab, you might say. And we kind of, okay, so this is the mirror game, and we simplified it because, again, coming from physics, we wanted to deal with simple to measure things. So even though, as we heard, you can now measure the 3D mirror game, big advance, so thank you. We narrowed it down to one dimension. And that means we build a machine, as you heard today from Tommy, that where you play the mirror game across two parallel tracks. One holds the red handle, the other the blue. And you play the mirror game just like you did. We verified subjectively that you get the same feeling, right? When we, okay. Yeah. Okay, and there's a little wheel here. This is connected with a rope to a little wheel that moves, and an electronic device measures its rotation, so you can get the position very accurately and high temporal resolutions. You can measure the motion very accurately, so scientists get very excited like when you can do that. And we did experiments in the living room with trained improvisers because we wanted to get a signal. And these lights tell you red leads, blue leads, or no leader, no follower, 1 minute each, counterbalanced. So, and this is the data. So, people not from science say, this looks like a, I don't know, like a dragon or something. But what this means is the position, and this is time. And just the point of this is to show that people can do different weird things. Blue and red, you see, they're pretty together. Blue and red are different players. We think it's better to look at the velocity, because we think, actually, when people are together, it's not the position. So you can have a tall dancer and a short dancer. But you still think it's together, because they start and stop at the same time. So it's the velocity, we think. And people do as complicated a motion in one dimension as we could hope. For instance, they do crescendos, they stop. Then they start doing this, like all kinds of games they discover, right? And all this is published in this work in PNAS 2011. And after we published this, we discovered there was previous work like Dumas, who's here, right? Working on free hand motion, and other work from the Harry lab. So there's a previous work on doing joint motion without a leader and follower. All right. Now, just to summarize in a slogan, we saw that together is better. That is to say, in a condition of no leader, no follower, these experts improvisers had larger range of velocities, better synchrony. They could actually stop and start together within a few tens of milliseconds, which is faster than responsive. They could stop and start together very precisely. And their motion was at least as complex as that of leaders, so they could do complex motion without leader and follower. And why is that? It's because when you look at the leader, now blue is designated as a leader. Leaders make smooth lines. That's a term from drawing. They make smooth lines. The followers jitter, so their velocity does this with a typical frequency of about 2 hertz, let's say. So there's a typical frequency. This jitter, which means doing this, is so common when you're a follower, 90% of the time, that we now had, we thought, a proxy or a measurement for who's following at any given moment. The person who's jittering around the other's direction. Now we can objectively believe, we now know to say who's following, even in the condition when there's no designated leader and follower. We can see who's jittering, and use that as a proxy for who's actually following at that moment. And now we can ask, can there really be joint improvised motion as two leaders? Or maybe it's always one person jittering, the other person jittering. So we had a tool to answer that. And we find that, just as you said there, one person jitters, then the other person jitters, without a designated leader. They both jitter. But then, about 10% of the time, the players are able to reach states which last a few seconds, where they're moving like two leaders. That's to say, neither of them has jitter, which we can evaluate using the power spectrum and that frequency. And their motion can be complex, like slowing down together, as complex as when you look at leaders' motion when there's a designated leader. We can know how we have both computerized ways to measure complexity using wavelet transforms, or letting people see graphs like this and asking them, rate this as complex, yes, no, medium, high. So both ways. We can measure complexity, they agree. And so people can make complex motion together. They can enter, it's a small fraction of the time, 10% maybe. They also always exit it. So people don't stay there. They exit it, which is now one of our main focuses. I mean, so we love to study togetherness and enter into synchrony. But there's also exit from synchrony. That's part of human behavior. And I think, in fact, the strength of relationships is not determined by how much synchrony you get into, but by ability to repair the exit from synchrony. So that's, for me now, a very interesting topic that we're focusing on. And now, all right. How can they do this? They seem to agree on future motion. And this is just traces. And these gray squares, we have a computer algorithm looking at jitter, telling us where there's this co-confident motion, two confident lines. So these are these gray areas. You see these players here have these areas where we judge their co-confidence. So we can quantitate that. And then, because, again, we come from physics, we're not satisfied. This is a problem with our upbringing. Until we have a mathematical model that can explain some aspects of it. Doesn't mean it's right. It means at least some model can explain an aspect of this, right? So, and this model, These letters are really impossible to read, I think, right? For you guys in the back. So I'm just going to describe it in a this what happens here is you imagine that the person looks at the other person's velocity and tries to match it as if there's a spring connecting the two people. This spring makes the jitter. Spring constant makes the jitter. Spring constant, I think, has to do with the delay lines we heard from Kaiser's talk today. Right, same time frame. Okay, so when you put in a sine wave, this will jitter around it. But when you take two of these, oh, sorry. There's another thing we know human beings have, which is, as I said, a predictor, like A, R, O, B. There's a predictor of future motion. When we start moving, we have a predictor. Think about this predictor. It also tries to learn the other person's motion. So not only are you reacting immediately, your predictor of future motion is trying to learn the other person's motion. When you now couple two of these, what happens is the two predictors synchronize. You have to have in your model predictors, which are telling us what game we're playing. And when those synchronize, they cancel out this jitter. There's a mode where those two springs subtract out when you add the equations, and you're left with two synchronized controls. So in control models, you have to have this controller in order to show this phenomenon of co-confident motion. And we're very interested, I think, in this talk to figure out what's the neural correlate of that, because it seems to me that has to do with this motor system. Anyway, so just to summarize, we started with wondering about togetherness in our theater shows. In general, in the world, we narrowed it down to transition joint improvisation. We narrowed it down to this mirror game, which is a little element from theater you can bring into the lab. We made it one-dimensional so we can study it. Got precise data. We even got a mathematical model, which has interesting predictions. For instance, the jitter frequency is also equal to the maximal frequency where you can be synchronized. And that actually appears to be true. That's like a mathematical prediction. Okay? And also, what velocity to go to maximize the probability of getting into togetherness. So somebody said, go slow, right? So there's a best speed that has to do. So like you can reflect now. And this reflected back now on how we do improvisation theater, because now we have these concepts like jitter to help us as actors from our body understand what state we're in. It's very awkward in the beginning to have concepts of this. But once they become natural, the feedback on our performance, and that's the cycle. All right. You're also, so heart rate synchronization, we linked this up to the concept of, psychological concept called attachment, so we could see person's attachment style and link with how they play the mirror game. That paper, I think, is about to be published too. And after this project, we started a theater lab, which is kind of a little part inside a science institute that has no arts, no social sciences, to use concepts from theater to form experimental paradigms, to study basic principles of human behavior, and now in this conference to finally get in touch with the wider community that does this. It's really, I have a feeling of solidarity and hope. Now here's some unpublished things. This has to do with creative leaps, okay? So I'm now going to leap into creative leaps. And again, this starts from wondering about something that we recognize from improvisation theater and science, which are moments of recognition that you can do something new. Like we say, we go on vacation and you, right, or you talk something. Okay. So how can we study creative leaps? And I just want to detoxify something. I say creative leaps in the audience. I often find out that I didn't explain myself well what I mean by creative leaps. So now there's creativity with capital C, like Picasso. Creativity with little c, like I discover, I can open it this way, not like something every day. Okay, so I'm talking about little c creativity, minor creative leaps, hoping that maybe it's similar mechanism. I don't know. And second, people think creativity is like solving a theorem. You have like a problem, and you have to solve it. And I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk more like artistic search, where there is no answer. You have a lot of options, and you guide yourself to what you think is interesting. This kind of search. So open-ended, small c. Okay. Did I explain myself? I'm delimiting the scope here. And this is a work of Leo and Yuval Hout, who's now postdoc at Harvard, studying physics and education. Current paradigms for studying creativity are, for example, draw as many different things in these circles, and you count fluency, how many different shapes people make, and originality, are the shapes made by this person similar to shapes other people described? And that's two measures of creativity. It's difficult. You have to hand code this. It's not clear how to, what's the distance between two solutions or what the path is. And we wanted to make a study of creativity where you can look at the microscopic steps people take to reach a solution and measure very precisely, multi-dimensional way, what happens in this kind of search, and to zoom in on creative leaps, like under the microscope, you could say. All right. All right. So here's Liol's brilliant invention. He decided that our space will be the shapes you can make from 10 squares, connected shapes. Okay. There's 36,000 possible shapes. Okay. That's our geometrics. That's our playground. And I'm going to explain this computer game that you play. This is always the initial condition. You have 10 squares like this. Each move, you can take a square and move it somewhere new, as long as they're still connected. Did I explain myself here? And so you're sculpting. You can't take something from the center, right, Phil? You play, you play, you play. Now, your instruction is very simple. It says, your goal is to explore the safe space of shifting shapes and to discover shapes that you find interesting and beautiful. That's the only thing. When you find the shapes interesting and beautiful, you put it into the gallery. No limit of number of shapes you can put into the gallery. That's all. Right? So you sculpt, you sculpt, you sculpt, you sculpt. In move 12, you find this thing, and you decide it's interesting and beautiful. Let's say you click on it, and it goes into the gallery. You see the previous shape you put in the gallery also. Okay, so did I explain myself here? Any questions? Yeah, if I take something from the center and move it, yeah, I'm going to get two disconnected shapes.
Okay, so
that's not allowed. I can move anything that keeps it connected. So this one, this one, this one, this one. So I can make 20 different shapes out of this. So we know all the paths between any shape and any shape. We can count how many steps it takes. What's the fastest way to get between airplane and the line? We have all knowledge of all the microscopic steps here and what the players did and when they clicked and what's the timing and everything, right? Because it's a computer game. Okay, so that's our playground. Okay. Now we are in our heaven of signals and we can use our analysis and so on. So first thing we discover is very simple. We just look at the when they choose gallery shape. So they move, 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 gallery shape, move, 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 gallery shape. Look at that time sequence. And we discover that there's two phases. People switch between two phases. One day they move, move, move about once per second, but the gallery choices are rare. And suddenly they go into stage where they're moving once per second, but they make gallery choices often. Okay? So these two phases. Then they go back to slow. Then they go back to fast. Then they go back to slow. I mean, they're not moving the squares faster, much faster, a little bit. But the rate at which they decide they found interesting shapes. So we're going to call this exploration and scavenging. You'll understand soon. Exploration and scavenging. They go from exploration to scavenging to exploration to scavenging. So that's just looking at the timing. And you can do statistical tests to see it's a two-state system. In scavenging, so the explore, 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 explore. Scavenge, scavenge, scavenge. They collect shapes. Now, when you look at the shapes they collect in a single scavenging phase, we call these a cluster, we look at them, and we see that they have shared meaning. Like, these are English letters. These are... these are animals. Maybe some of them have names, some of them don't have names. We know that they have shared meaning because we take people who didn't play the game, we show them three letters, three shapes from one cluster, another shape from another cluster, and ask them what's the odd shape out. And they know. So we know these are, people can perceive these are different meanings. Okay, so, all right, so they scavenge things from letters, let's say letter. One person scavenged 22 letters, 22 Hebrew letters. Okay, it's like, all right. This is just what I said. You can tell the odd shape out, and therefore we know that they have shared meaning. Now, when we look at exploration and scavenging, as I said, We can look at the actual moves, and we also know the shortest moves between two gallery shapes. When they're exploring, people don't move by the shortest path. They move about twice the shortest path between gallery shapes. So they're kind of wandering around. In scavenging, when they found letters, let's say, they go from letter to letter along the shortest paths. So once they're scavenging, what they're doing, they understood the potential to find, let's say, letters, and they just go for letters. They ignore everything else, they go for letters. And then they leave it, they drop it, and they start exploring until they find the possibility of finding airplanes. And then they start getting airplanes, and then they drop it. And we didn't tell them to do that. They do that on their own. Okay. So now we can focus on the moment they understand that they can do a certain class of shapes. That moment is very interesting for us because it's our proxy for a creative leap. When does the person recognize that they can do a new kind of shape? We think that's what's happening, right? Suddenly they make letters. So also in the mirror game. You say it also happened in the mirror game. Yeah, so there's a link between the two things I'm talking about. I agree. There's a joint discovery process sometimes. Yeah. So, for instance, this is an exploration phase. Person found this, found that, put that in the gallery. And then that person found this. Okay? And that was the turning point. After this, they started moving in direct path and found the numbers. We call this shape the four that is not a four. What do I mean by that? I mean, when we look at the numbers, almost everyone finds numbers. We look at the numbers shared by the number cluster shared by different people, we see the prototypical numbers. Those are the things shared by different people. The four is not a four is not prototypical. Just for this person was what we'll call the creative leap. This shape. It's a non-prototypical shape followed by prototypical. That's a property we see for these transition shapes. We define them, of course, by the boundary between search and expression that we look just from timing, right? You have to understand. We don't say these are creative leaps. We interpret them as creative leaps, but we can define them according to the timing. And here are different clusters of numbers discovered by different people, and each person, this is real, found their way to numbers from a different transition shape or creative leap shape. Now, different people get to this four of not a four. A lot of them just continue. They don't see the potential for numbers. Or they get to four number four and discover airplanes, let's say, or something like that. So transition shapes are unique to each person. They're not prototypical. Transition shape, I mean, like creative leap shape. Okay. And they are more unique, that's to say, they're shapes. Among all the shapes chosen to the gallery, they're found by the least number of other people. They're very unique shapes. So they're like original in the sense of creativity theory. And I also want to say that we found something that I'm really fascinated by. When we look at different people, so different people all have these creative leaps and everything. But if I plot here how long a certain person's exploration phases, so how many moves, how many gallery shapes they choose in the exploration phase, and how many moves they have in their scavenging phase. So each person is a point here. That's their average exploration duration, the scavenging duration. Different people fall on a line like this, which means to say there's a pattern to human variability in the search strategies. Some people explore briefly, find something new, drop it quickly. Other people explore a long time, find something new, stay there a long time, drop it, okay? There's empty space here. We don't know why. I should say we also were able to make a mathematical model of a searcher in high-dimensional meaning shapes. So what we think we can do here is take this shape of space, shapes, assign meaning to it according to what people discovered, find 13 meaning clusters like that. And now we can model, have the computer make searches in this meaning space by climbing up meaning gradients. But in order to do that, the computer needs two variables that for us might point at psychological variables there. The first variable is focusing. So meaning shape, meaning space, the meanings are not that all airplanes are here and all digits are here. No, they're like packed together, digits near airplanes. It's like a cake that has raisins, almonds, chocolate. But when a person first finds chocolate, they only see chocolate. So we need a variable that focuses your attention. It's like a vector that aligns with one dimension of meaning. Chocolate, 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 ignoring all the other stuff. And then another variable we need, which is saturation, which is, I'm sick of chocolate. I'm not and now open up the search. And you encounter raisins. Raisins, 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 raisins. I'm sick of raisins. Okay, we need these two variables, which are unlike anything else in statistical mechanics. Perfect. Not like simulated annealing, hill climbing. And they're very interesting for us to explore more, maybe, with the tools that you guys have. So I'm going to just summarize. We want to explore with this paradigm joint creativity. What happens if we have a group playing together like this? Maybe like scientists. Scientists, you know, there are different kinds of scientists. Some of them discover something new, publish a paper, drop it, go to... Other scientists do their PhD thesis their whole life. Both, I think, are essential if we want to maximally recover those raisins in chocolate, right? So, but this diversity of styles, I'm interested to simulate that. And to ask about questions of joint creativity, maybe unite these two talks, like you said, the mirror game, which is kind of a joint improvisation, and this way of looking at creative searches with a small c. All right, so I'm going to stop here, and maybe we have 4 minutes so we can take questions. Okay, fine. So, yeah. All right, so I start with you. And thank you.
Okay, a quick question. Do you have correlated these explorations scavenging time constant with like some psychological trait, like impulsiveness or?
So your question, maybe this correlates with a psychological trait like risk seeking. We haven't. Really very interesting, yeah.
Can I ask my...
Can I ask?
Okay. Yeah, I just had an urgent question listening to your talk. I was wondering about the instruction of this latest study with the shapes, because you asked people about making beautiful and interesting shapes, but it seems that you found that actually they are making meaningful shapes. Do you think would it change if, I don't know, who were your participants? Would it change if you would use visual artists, for example, as participants?
What is your prediction? These are non-artists.
These are non-artists, and for them, the words beautiful and interesting are a little bit ambiguous.
So this touches, in my opinion, the difference between kitsch and art. This is kitsch, basically. This is meaning. This is okay.
Okay, thank you. That was wonderful. I really appreciate the cloud. It's definitely something I see a lot in philosophy PhDs. So it's not only in the sciences. I just wanted to, it's just a comment. I've been involved for more than 2 decades in an improvisational practice, and it's interesting to me to hear you speak of it, because it's really exactly my experience of it. So in the, this is a dance practice, and we work with constraints such that it is actually quite easy for us to tell if something does emerge that is outside of the model of leading or following. Our experience of that is that it's very seldom, like maybe a few minutes an hour. Of course, there's a tiny bit of variation the whole time. It's not that, you know, we've been dancing a long time. But recently, we realized that there was something really interesting that happens when we get tired. So I just wanted to draw that out. So there is and I'll talk about this tomorrow night in terms of volition, but I'm very interested in non-volitional movement. And when you begin an experiment in improvisation, what appears to be volitional movement seems to be quite dominant in cases where people have access to volitional movement. And I think it has something to do with a capacity to exclude more. So there's a capacity to have clarity in the relationship in the relation, really. As the tiredness comes in, it gets vaguer. And so from a perspective of the outside, it looks messier. But something really interesting is happening there, which is not so different from the cloud, in the movement. And in that moment of improvisation, I think I haven't studied it per se, but I know that as a dancer, those are the moments where something really interesting is happening. So just
thank you.
Yeah, this reminds me of another set of experiments that research people's gambling behavior in casino.
Gambling.
Yeah, so when you're sitting in front of a slot machine, when you don't get the money coming down, there are two type of people. One is he would continue staying in front of the same machine, right, because I already invested, yeah. The next one must be coming. There's another kind, it's like, oh, it's not coming, let me drop it and move to another slot machine. So it looked like there are two type of people. Wow. Two type of decision making, yeah. And then they use different two turns. One is called exploration, the other one is exploitation.
Yeah.
And then the two turn has been used in neuroscience. So I can kind of remind me of the two kind of observation. That's very interesting.
Yeah. I think science is addictive because it doesn't work, and so rarely it works. It's unscheduled rewards, just like in gambling. And I also want to say, we tried exploitation, but we broke our tongue like this. So we didn't say scavenging now. You think we should go to exploration, exploitation?
No, I think your turn's better.
Scavenging. Yeah.
Hi. I wonder if you measure originality. Like, for instance, where, well, they brought up like a really rare shapes.
Yeah.
Like the phase of exploring may be more interesting, even because they probably one of the subject just, you know, in that stage brings up all these weird shapes and it's very original.
Let me see. I want to see if I understood. Are you suggesting that in instruction we mention originality?
I'm saying that in creativity you usually measure three things, right? Number of categories,
right.
Which you do
number
here,
of categories.
Right? Fluency.
Which number of shapes.
Number of shapes. And then the originality, which usually you have like a bank of what's
yeah. So
more
we measure
common.
Originality,
that's what I was wondering.
So we have a database of what people discovered.
That's what I was asking.
Each shape, we can know how rare is it that other people you don't know about discovered the same shape. So we know that the creative leap shapes, like four that is not a four, are highly original.
So that's what what I was thinking. Because when she was asking if artists will... I mean, how would they perform?
Yeah.
I would guess that... Yeah.
And we see a search strategy in a few people that resonates with me. I don't know, I have no proof with artists' way of doing, which is instead of finding a four is not a four and then digits, we find shapes we can't classify, but the person is like, ends up with the most original shape. So as if, here's just a story, they're improving until they get something they're satisfied with. It's just a guess. Which is highly original, and this may be another way of
measuring,
playing, and then dropping it. And I don't know, just a story. I mean, but we observe that in the data. Oh yeah, thanks. We have an expert here.
We did it half in half, but if you like non-official with artists and non-artists, and I find many of the artists they dislike the symmetrical shape, the meaningful shape.
Yeah.
They would say they want this yeah. kind of people.
Yeah, that's what I was.
Exactly,
yeah, that's what I would expect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. So and there's plenty of questions. This is great. Yeah, you, then you. Yeah. Oh, you have the microphone. Okay. So we have an abundance of questions. So.
Yeah, if I can add up on that originality aspect, me, I'm an artist in visual art, and I create in series, and I do drawings and photographic collage that can be very improvised shapes, and also sometimes. Our originality comes because I make a series. So it's not that the first one is interesting, but it's because I make a series that suddenly the series become interesting. So in that evaluation? Sometimes it's because there is a series that suddenly it looks so interesting.
Exactly. So the series, for me, I think that artists and also people in this game, after the game, we ask them to look at the shapes and tell us which they think is most creative, only at the end of the game. And they choose their creative leap shapes as most creative. And I think a lot of times you have a personal breakthrough. As a scientist, sometimes I discover something that opens up a new research program for me. But it's very idiosyncratic. It's rough. It's weird. But I love it. Afterwards come the clean works.
That is a variation.
Yeah, yeah. Now, textbooks written right when the subject is discovered have these weird cases. And 300 years later, just like mechanics, they have the clean cases. So we get an illusion that science is clean. But the discoveries are messy. They're not idiosyncratic. They're not clean. They're uncertain. They're messy. They're the four that is not a four. So again, it's a kind of a historiography. And it's just like the series of works. In the end, you get the textbook cases, which are clean. You decide now. You so I'm gonna, I don't want to get in trouble. I'm going to put the trouble on you.
No. Okay.
Okay, so.
So, where's the comment, really? To join your C's up, maybe.
Can you say again, please?
Join your C's, the two C's. So
the two C's?
No, the creative C's.
The small C?
The small and the big one. C. So, there's some studies of...
Oh, it's the same C, I love it. It's not a, I just never noticed that, but it's actually the same. It's a big C, it's the C, the cloud, the C, the small C, the big C.
It's C, you
leap, a great
C. A C of C's.
And the B, the B, B, what? Is what? The B? The bee makes honey. The bee makes honey. I see. Okay, I'm sorry.
Let's go back to Patrick.
Okay, sorry.
No, that was better.
Okay.
So there are some studies of the creative stages of graphic design, architectural design, and we did something on musical composition where people are in the early stages they draw, and the key representations for when there's a significant change, is always that there's an ambiguous external representation, like your four, right? Where you can reinterpret the external representation, and that leads to a big change in the design process.
Okay, so what's the reference the for that?
Compositional. So the best one is Gabriella Goldschmidt.
Okay, Rio, are you writing this down? Because we didn't publish this yet. We're pre-rejected. I mean, we submitted it to many respectable journals, but we haven't published it yet. So... So what you say, we also see in our data, because we look at this four, it's not a four. Let's see those transition shapes.
We lost
and, wait, yeah, I stopped you in the middle.
It's fine.
And we ask, sometimes people go through them, but sometimes they discover clusters. And we can judge ambiguity by the fraction of time the shape is the entry into more than one cluster. And we find that these transitions are ambiguous in the sense that they can be the entry portals into, let's say, numbers, 9, 3, 5, and, let's say, animals. I don't know exactly in this. Okay. So that's, we can measure ambiguity here, let's say, objectively.
So there's good analogies to exactly that process in design, musical composition. And
super. Thanks.
My question is about this exactly.
Okay.
But it may also be about interpretation, about, you know, how you interpret things.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking. The four that doesn't look like a four, you say, leads a person to discovering a new structure, like a series. And that is a breakthrough. I would be interested in a four that doesn't look like a four that would lead into a five that doesn't look like a five, a six that doesn't look like a six, and, you know, things like that that maintain, preserve the ambiguity.
You look for an artist.
The tension within... Well, now we're talking about creative leaps here, right? Have you had this, Leo? Have you had... things like that, because obviously there's a release when you're stuck.
Yeah.
There's a release. Hey, four, let's do numbers.
Yeah.
But is it that?
We didn't see it so much. And my sense,
we didn't see it so much in my sense. There is some stress that we never measure, and we will need to measure it some by being in this exploration phase. So people are kind of relieved, like I said, from going from chaos to order. So, okay, now I understand what's going on. Now I do digits as a leak. And then after half a minute, you're bored with it and you go exploring again. So my intuition is people have this need for a safe place, and then it's very safe to do. And it's all very self-perceived. Nobody look at them. Nobody tells them what they find. They decide. But it's a good idea to look at if we have this pattern also.
So just to add to this, I think there's a consciousness for us to recognize symbols, like for brands, like you buy Nike and then we're happy, or something about like where you feel comfortable with this recognizing the symbols and numbers. Or I think maybe it's very depending on the generation also. So this research must be very moving a lot. I don't know, I feel like from one generation to the other, it's a very different concept of and which country, and if it's in a communist country, they all have to think in the same way, so they probably have this discipline to think the same symbols.
This is a question about where do you see this in different cultures, for example?
Absolutely.
And I'm very fascinated with that. Thank goodness now we can play this on the computer with 83 cultures and 10,000 people. We haven't done that yet, but it shouldn't be too difficult.
We should do it.
We should do it, yeah. And my guess is that different cultures will be just like different people. Stereotypes of cultures are an exaggeration of differences between individuals in any culture. That's my guess. It would be like that. But
there's one question there with the microphone.
Yes. I spoke, but I just wanted to say basically that, like, to me, a creative leap also has to do something with change. So it's like when, like, they said that afterwards you have, like, the same shapes. But, like, so that becomes something which becomes normal again. And to get another creative leap, it triggers change again. Because it's something really new, a leap, like, from the unknown to the known.
Yeah.
Or to the unknown, from the known to the unknown.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was thinking of applying the how to repair the togetherness to the exercise of the shapes. Did you measure the length of the exploration time, and did it get better in the sense of did it get shorter and shorter as the people were going through the experiment? Or did you notice some kind of, I don't know, pleasure to linger in the exploration time?
So the question
time is,
as you do more and more, the first exploration phase is a different one. I think the first one is slightly longer, but the other ones are not dwindling. They're not dwindling. There's like it's like an individual signature of the person almost. They're more constant between different exploration phases within a person than they are between different people.
Mm.
Whatever.
One more question.
So this is the tiredness. The tiredness factor now coming in. So
I wonder. I wonder if you have.
I don't see who's. Oh yeah.
I wonder if you have some paradigm about this specific method in a joint model, like with two people doing compositions.
How two people can play the creativity game?
Yeah.
So maybe Lior can answer that. Lior, can you answer how two people can do the creativity game?
This is our next plan for next. So like we said, we're interested in combining these two kind of paradigms. I mean, you can imagine something like one person is playing with blue tiles, second person with red tiles, and they do together. And you know, maybe there is this moment of understanding, we're doing airplanes now. But this is just thoughts.
Or maybe a community of searchers who publish papers say, look, we discovered airplanes, and then like a herd effect, everybody goes to airplanes, unless you're the person who doesn't want to go like everybody else does, and you can do it like science.
Okay. How about sound? This is working with images.
Yeah.
How would this work with sounds? Mirror games also are working with images, and you're soliciting always the same sense. About, and you end up with some constants about universalities, two Earths, three Earths. How would we adjust if this would be a sound game or something?
There is work on people that say singing together, improvising singing together.
Yeah.
When you're in a choir and you don't know the music, you fake it, and you have some delay, and you kind of oscillate around the right pitch.
Is it the same frequency?
I guess so. Something similar, yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm blanking out now. Now, my glucose level has dropped. This extreme sport of answering so many amazing questions. We have to take care of the body now by champagne, okay, and other modes of taking care of ourselves. Okay, so I want to thank you. This question is Lior also. I'm so happy that you're here.
Yeah, it's fun.
And also for us to later talk about these questions and get some references from you guys, right, about previous work, as you saw, a lot of ignorance. Like, meeting you guys is, like I say, a lot of solidarity. So thank you very much for asking, participating in the Mirror Game, and I hope we continue with this enjoyable conference.